Okay, here we are, starting a tiny bit late, 10:18. Partly my fault, partly confusion about rooms. Oh, well, we won't say it's 10:18 and we'll go by that clock. That way we get... Yeah, that way we get longer. No, I mean, trust that clock, that's right. So what I was saying, yes, about the direction the course is going in, and how this is different to how it's been done before, just diving really... in a way, it's been a kind of a reading group, hasn't it? We've just taken this text, and we've gone into it in absolute detail. I've kind of satisfied a yearning in me, in a way, because I've been to several reading groups, philosophical reading groups, and I've always wished they were like this. Generally, you say, OK, this week we're going to read three chapters... And then you have an hour to go into it, and you never go into anything properly, and you kind of skim over something, and in a way, if you try to do all of phenomenology, you do the same thing, you'd skim, whereas it's a kind of subject that if you just go into the depth once, you've got the whole of it. It's not a matter of reading everything that Husserl wrote and then going into what Heidegger wrote and trying to figure out the entire landscape. That's the sort of thing a professional philosopher would do, and come to some kind of an opinion about who was right on this, who was right on that, what was their thesis, how has it been developed by people subsequent. That's a kind of classical way you'd study phenomenology. We haven't done it that way. We've just taken this section of the crisis and we've gone as far as we can go into it, because I'm interested in the very core insight that lies behind phenomenology, and in passing that on. For me, that's far more important than having a kind of an encyclopedic, is that a right word? Encyclopedic knowledge of phenomenology, which in fact I don't have, because I'm not a professional philosopher. I'm not paid to do philosophy, and that means I do philosophy in relation to my own self-knowledge. I'm interested in philosophy if it informs me of something I didn't recognise or realise before. And if I read something and it's not giving me anything like that, I just say, well, next. So this section of the crisis ends with one more reading. If we get through this reading, then there's just one more for next week. I'm going to see how it goes. That gives us a week at the end to kind of sum up. We might sum up, or we might not finish, and we might need it to finish what we're reading. We'll see. If you see anyone, send them in here. Yes. So last week we were looking, and once again, are you all having the same feeling as me? I can't remember what we did last week, but I can just about remember the title, which was, what was it?
We went deep into the epoche.
Yes. Did I call it the universal epoche? Yeah. Yes. We went into what that means, and this week, in the sort of stream of the narrative, we're looking into... So, okay, we're assuming that we're there and we're looking around. And in a way, Husserl has been looking around within the epoche already in all that he's been writing. So quite a lot of what's in the reading this week, if it's in your memory, it should be familiar. But it's a kind of distilled. I'm having a lot of admiration this week for what Husserl's writing, because I've attempted to go into this myself and write this myself, and coming back on how Husserl has put things, I realise that even if you find the way that he writes difficult, there's almost an economy. I don't think he could say it any more simply, because he's trying to talk about experience from the perspective of transcendental subjectivity, of which there is no model. It's not as if we have a model. It's not as if we have a ready-made language with which to do it. He's having to invent his language as he goes along. Not new words. Heidegger was an expert in... Not an expert. Heidegger liked to invent new words. Husserl's trying to do it within existing language. But in doing that, it's kind of quite... almost deceptive, because he's using... In a way, if you use a whole load of new words, you'd realise he's trying to say something that's never been said before. But because he's using words that are familiar... There's a kind of a level where you think, well, he's saying something quite ordinary here. But if we get into the heart of what he's saying, it should be turning your own world kind of topsy-turvy. It's the epoché. It's this ordinary state that we're in, where we take the world for granted. And we take the being of the things that we experience for granted. It's the best way I kind of experience it is you just, in a way, you open your eyes and you just see the world. And you don't have any consciousness of the consciousness that is behind it. We all tend to wake up like that unless we take some kind of deliberate pulling back. We're just there. It's difficult to explain, but one looks out of one's eyes, and I think that everything around me is actually there just as I see it. That's the experience, isn't it? That's actually how things are, and in a way it is. But in a way, you're forgetting or not recognizing that at the same time. It's being projected out of you. And today, as I was looking into the lecture and what I wanted to say, I kind of wanted to do something a bit tricky, because Husserl's the first epoché is the epoché of objective science, which in a way means you have to forget the brain and what the brain's doing. And if you start thinking about what the brain's doing, it's quite easy to get confused, because in a way you're jumping from a kind of a place where you're treating everything something purely subjective, and then you're suddenly introducing an objective view of things. But I'd still like to try and do that, so long as we can kind of stay alert. Because the thing is, when you introduce an objective view of things, it's so fascinating in a way. You can get sucked into it, and sucked out of the epoché, and sucked into an objectified scientific view of things, because it's so embedded in us already, even if we're not scientists. It's a certain view of things that, as soon as you get near it, it's got a centre of gravity, and it will pull you in. But at the same time, you see, the reason I like to introduce brain science into this is because modern theories of what the brain's doing actually correspond with what Husserl's saying. And this is a validation of what he's saying, that the current understandings of what the brain is doing, it's almost like Husserl is at a certain level reading that out of experience. But you see the danger is, so you immediately think, oh well, what Husserl was doing, he was just doing kind of studying the brain, as if the brain is what's producing experience. That's the error, in a way. The error, once you see what the brain's doing, and you fall into that scientific view of things, it does look like the brain is producing this experience. In what way? Well, in the most obvious way, the most compelling way. If you have a stroke and some part of your brain's damaged, then your experience utterly changes. You know, it's not a kind of a Yes.
Yeah, but at the same time, our brain experiences millions of things. Is that exactly what in ourselves makes us acknowledge certain experiences in a way? Because, you know, there are loads of processes that we just simply don't acknowledge. So what's within us makes us acknowledge certain experiences and some just go past us.
Yes. I mean, from the perspective of brain science, they're honing in now on what it means to be conscious in terms of what's going on in the brain. And so there are an awful lot of processes going on in the brain of which we are not conscious. And there are certain processes going on in the brain, and even here you have to use the language rightly, of which we're conscious. The best way to put it is that when those processes are happening, then you're conscious. And if they stop happening, then your consciousness, at least of the world, is gone. And that, I guess what brain science is now looking into is, well, what is it about those processes that distinguishes them from all the others you're talking about that are obviously going on in the background, obviously determining a lot of stuff, you know, especially our, you know, in our limbic system, our emotional responses to things. We're often completely unaware of them, and yet they're deeply influencing the way we see things. How is that all working? And science is going to come up, I think. Current theories are looking at the fact that the part of the brain which is associated with consciousness is, all the neurons there in their firing have got into a synchrony. They're starting to fire together. So there are certain firing rhythms going on in the brain, and the rhythm of firing can various subpopulations of neurons start to become connected together by the frequency of their firing. And others are firing more chaotically or randomly and aren't in synchrony with the part of the brain that's conscious. I know I'm going on, but I'm just sort of amplifying what you were saying and how brain science is starting to have a kind of a corresponding physical objective picture of what we experience. And if we can think about it in the right way, it's a terribly useful model, because it's not just something that somebody made up. It's an actual observation of phenomena that are occurring. Yes, I think one of the things that's left to be done with phenomenology, as it was passed on to us, is to connect it up to brain science. But the problem with brain science and its understanding is it knows nothing of the epoche. It knows nothing of consciousness itself. And it thinks that the brain, the physical brain, is doing everything. And the epoche, if we understand it essentially, is the realization that can't be so.
I'm sorry, I'm late. Hello.
Hello, Rekha. It's all right, we haven't got to slide one yet.
Okay.
We're still having the introduction. Why can't it be so? Because our conscious experience is an experience of a unity of meaning. And in a way, you know, all you need to do, Leibniz, or centuries ago, he said this. He said, well, if you were to make yourself microscopic and you went for a walk in the brain, you would find no meaning, no unified, meaningful experience. If we manage to identify that group of cells in the brain that are firing in synchrony at the moment that correspond to your being conscious, there's no colour in there. There's no shape in there. There's no space in there. What consciousness is affecting, if we think of things in those terms, is the entire world that you're experiencing now is it's mirrored in the structure of what's happening in the brain, but obviously it isn't what's happening in the brain. The best way that I can put it is what you're experiencing is an understanding of what's happening in the brain. And that puts it in a certain light, which is just a picture, a model. Because it's not, I don't think it is, that sort of makes it look like there's a little person looking at the brain and saying, "Ah, I understand what's going on there, and I'll just turn that into this experience." How what's going on in the brain becomes this projection of meaning is essentially inexplicable.
How the object becomes subject?
Well, in a way,
I'd
like to change the language there, because the entire projection, if you like, is all that we really know. So even our idea that there is an object and a subject is in there, right? That's just another meaning that is being projected. I mean, if you get into this far enough, you should start feeling that the ground under your feet is disappearing, because this projection that I'm talking about, once you enter into what that really means, I'm speaking as if I were outside of it. But you can't ever be outside of it. You know, what I'm saying now is a projection of meaning within that field. We keep tricking ourselves, and science does this, by imagining that somehow I can place myself outside of this field and see it objectively. But you're never outside of that field. That field for us is all being is in there. It's what Nicolet once called the great dome of experience. And if I'm happy to say that Heraclitus says something like that, if we get to it, if you've done the reading, it was in the reading. The sort of picture of where we are is we so easily forget that it's this domain of in the clearing of being, the space of consciousness, that's what is for us. But we start developing pictures and explanations, like the brain explanation, and thinking that in some way or other, this is caused by something else. But when you look into it properly, you can see that whole model of causation just explains how things are connected within the projection. Do you see? Causation says, well, if A happens, then typically B happens. Or if we get very scientific, if A happens up until now, B always happens. But where is A, and where do A and B appear? They appear in the field of consciousness. And what science, in a way, another way of thinking of how science works, is it thinks that the things that are appearing in the field of consciousness could cause the field. And it's a kind of an absurdity to think that. Nevertheless, if you're absolutely wedded to the ultimate reality of the material world, you do end up thinking that. And many, many people who think about this end up in a position like that, because they... Well, I don't want to give a psychological interpretation, but because if you let go of that, then and it's almost like the floor opens up underneath you. What you thought of as certain being starts to become an enigma, as Husserl has said. So that's a brief introduction to the fact that I may be starting alluding to the brain as we go along. And it was a kind of a warning to not get sucked into that view, compelling as it is. And I only give that warning because I get sucked into that view. It's you know, it happens to me. I'm continually having to pull back from that scientific conception of things. And that pulling back is this entering into the epoche. And in a way that it often helps to shut your eyes. I'm not saying, when I'm definitely, the last thing I want is a meditation group. But if you're on your own and looking into this, it does help, because it's vision that is the most compelling sense in terms of sucking you into a sense of the objectivity of the being of things. Ah, is this the entire core now?
James.
But he's
only
on time.
He is.
Yeah. If there's a law here that says that there has to be one. Yes.
No, it's just the Michael, the champion of attendance.
I think you'd think it's right. I think. Yeah. I think it's right.
Phenomenal.
No, there's no star till the end, you know. Or there's many a slip twixt cup and lip, you know.
And John.
And no, John's missed. No, John. No, oh. John hasn't made it all. No. Well, there's you and I, Nicolette, but I don't think we can. So I'm going to start after that introduction. Just, and it's all right. We're
first slide.
To perceive an individual thing, even if it is perceived as remaining unchanged, is something complex. It is to see it, to touch it, to smell it, to hear it, etc. And in each case, I have something different. I'll just pause there. Because I may have mentioned this before, but I always pause and feel how amazing it is that there are all these... they're absolutely distinct. The field, the visual field, and the oral field. I mean, I know that the synesthesia, where the senses can get in some way influence each other. So people can, if they see a word, they also see the word as coloured. And that's like there's an association of colour with things at a certain level. I know people on psychedelic drugs can see sound. But so when I say that the fields are utterly separate, you might be thinking something like that. But even if you hear some music, or my voice, and you see something coming out of my mouth that corresponds to what I'm saying, what you're seeing is still in the visual field, and what you're hearing is still in the oral field, and what you touch, do you see your sense of touch? There's no hearing in it whatsoever. All of these fields are completely self-enclosed. They have their own dimension. And where do I think? You know, when I think, where's that occurring? It's not even spatial. Do I hear what I think? There's a kind of... do you know there's a dimension of thinking that's quite extraordinary, isn't there? We can hardly describe it. And they're all distinct. And yet there's a unity of consciousness where they're all joined together, and by means of them we identify. You know, it's not like the unity appears in the object itself. Do you see the things of the world pull all of those fields together and give us a sense that there's a place where they all meet. They all meet in our experience of the world. I mean, you just couldn't. I'm a bit of a computer scientist, you know. You could just couldn't make something like the unity of our experience. What is this consciousness that's able to put all of these things simultaneously together that are obviously different and have a sense that it's all part of one experience? Do you know, this is again, it's the epoché. What Husserl's doing is he's saying, well, let's look into this field. It's amazing. When you withdraw from the what we do is we just see the objects, and you withdraw back and you see, well, how is it being put together? It's quite an extraordinary achievement. And again, I want to throw you back to the brain. Do you see, there's nothing in the brain that corresponds to this. That if you look at what's happening in the oral neocortex, where all the sound is being, you know, processed, it looks just like the visual cortex. There's just neurons doing their fiery stuff, connected to other neurons that are then going to fire or not fire according to the connections that they've made. The entire brain, when you look into the structure, it's doing the same kind of thing. The neocortex itself, which is associated with our human intelligence, when you see maps of it, they're saying, oh, you know, there's the visual cortex, and up here, you know, there's the frontal cortex, that's where we do our thinking. And it all looks like they're like little modules, specialised modules for doing this sort of stuff. But when you look into it, there's an amazing uniformity of structure over the whole thing. There are certain differences in certain areas, but it's certainly not like we've got a vision machine here, a hearing machine there, a thinking machine there, a language machine there. The basic structure of the neocortex is that the cells are divided into, if you were to take it, it's a wrinkly thing over the top of the head. If you were to take it and flatten it out, it would be pretty uniform in the structure. Taking it in cross-section, there are generally, people argue about how many layers there are, because it's not that clear, but there are recognised about 6 layers of different kinds of cells, and recognisable connections between them. And it's recognised that the cells themselves form little localized columns all over the entire neocortex. And not only that, areas of columns are connected together in ways that form sort of regions, and those regions in the neocortex are connected to each other in a somewhat hierarchical structure. So in vision, there's the back of the neocortex, there's V1. All right. Where's everything going? Oh, well done. Yeah. Nick stole the cups. Yeah. So, you know what the brain does is to do with what it's connected to. There's all kinds of vivisection and horrible experiments that have been done on little ferrets, where they disconnect a certain sensory input to one part of the young ferret's brain, and reconnect it to another part of the brain. And basically, the different part of the brain will still be able to see or hear. What makes the brain see or hear is the fact that it's connected to an ear or to an eye.
So you can connect the brains together.
Well, in a way, that's what we're doing now, isn't it?
And then you establish like a nervous connection between different brains.
Yes, but do you hear? In a way, that's what we're doing now. There's a certain part of the connection is translated into sound, and then goes in your ear. But in a way, it's like a neural signal that I'm sending to you, isn't it?
So on those experiments with the ferrets, did they... Oh, God, it's horrible to think about it. But so did they connect sort of what reads sounds to the, say, the thing that reads touch. Sort of, is that what they did? Sort of like to wire it wrong to see if the thing that reads touch would be connected to the ear, if we would still hear.
I read the details of many years ago, and I've forgotten the details and come just to the basic. I mean, I'm not even sure if it was the ear that was disconnected, but one of the sensory streams was physically disconnected from the part of the brain that usually deals with it and just reconnected to another part.
Yeah, okay.
And then they were tested to see if they were deaf, because of course the ferret can't say, I can't hear. yes, but if they still respond to sound,
yeah, then you know.
Yeah.
And did they?
Yes.
Which would say prove what?
Which would say that there was an original theory that says that the neocortex is divided into specialized areas developed through evolution that were to do with seeing or to do with hearing or to do with thinking or to do with touch. And the result of that is to say that's not so. The whole neocortex seems to be doing the same thing. And it will adapt to whatever input you give it, and in some way or other, within its hierarchy, it will make sense of that input. I mean, what the hierarchy is doing is it's finding correlations between, and I have to say between, I shouldn't say this because it's a wrong picture, between input and output, because the neocortex is also continuously giving signals to the motor commands to the muscles, so it's a cyclic thing. It's not just because we tend to think that way, because in class we sort of sit here and we put our bodies to sleep, you know, and we, in a way the epoche is a sheer just trying to look at the input to the senses, even though that's not true because I'm looking all over the room all the time, you know, even the movement of your eyes is continuously occurring. If you actually do freeze yourself and just stare at something, then you the visual field just goes away.
No, but it's like it's a well-known fact that those who lose some sort of senses, their other senses compensate.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's all kinds of evidence that a guy who lost his sight very early, I mean maybe at birth, who learnt to just making click noises.
Echolocation.
Yeah, he learnt to develop a spatial sense of the world, but he couldn't see, because you do need a retina to see, but he started to use the brain scanning is starting to indicate that people who are blind start to use visual cortex to process their hearing, so that because you can't just kind of click your tongue and start to get a three-dimensional sense of the world, but if there's a whole area of your brain that's not being used, then connections will grow so that it is used, and you can start to extend one sense into the unused area of the brain that was supposed to be used by vision, and you can develop echolocation. But I mean, it's the whole thing is the brain itself is fascinating, you know, because partly, you know, when you're a baby, it's absolutely chock-a-block full of connections. Well, the way we learn is that the connections die. In other words, certain ones of them start to be used and reinforced, and the ones that aren't used just fade away. That's why you end up as old people, you know, you just see what you expect to see. Do you know that your sort of sensory openness gets more and more closed? Which is, I think, it's great if you want to survive in the jungle, but maybe not so good if you just, you know, want to be. Yes, that was an enormous digression on sentence one about how the sensory fields are all separate and yet unified. But in spite of this, it is the same thing. The individual thing is the same thing. We don't experience it all split up in all these other dimensions and say, gosh, you know, I better just concentrate on the vision side, I'll just concentrate on what I'm hearing, because if I concentrate on them both, well, they're so different. I can't work out what's going on. Again, if we're looking into the brain, of course, the looking at the brain and these regions of the neocortex connected together hierarchically, there's a level where what's all of the different sensory fields are connected up to a common area. And that common area, if you like, what it's doing is it's working out how these different fields are correlated. And it's around about that level in the hierarchy that we would assume, and this is still theory, that the idea of an object arises, that there's a thing out there, and that all of these different sensory fields that are picking stuff up, it's almost mathematical. There are things happening there. My finger, I see my finger, yes, and my motor command. But it's when the finger meets the resistance of the table, there's a sound. Do you see? They are connected. But how are they connected? Well, they're connected in the presence or the projection of our idea of something that does connect them. Do you see? It's not that there's the object out there that informs, that just appears to us. The brain takes an extraordinary level of sophistication in the brain to be able to see the correlations between all of the information that's coming through all the senses and recognize that all of that stuff coming in, there's something that it has in common. And in its recognition, and remember, the brain doesn't recognize, I recognize, but that's why I'm saying careful how we use language here. Its recognition becomes the experience of there being a table here. But then we forget all that. We don't inhabit that. We just see the table. And of course, I'm a half a scientist. The theory of evolution comes in and says, well, there were a bunch of people that remained aware of all of that stuff that was going on in the brain, and they're dead. You know, they were eaten. You know, they weren't quick enough. You know, they just weren't fast enough. They were going, wow, it's just, you see how all the fields and the senses are, how they're all separate and then they connect together. And then, the tiger is in the room and you say, well, look at the stripes. They're just so amazing. You know, evolution steps in there. It's clear why we had to, you know, we didn't develop a whole inner sense of what the brain's doing. But in a way, that's what we're doing, right? That's what we're doing here. Because culture and civilization have granted us the space to start to look into this.
This is why you have to have a certain sense of ground, secure ground, inner and outer, to go into such things where you won't be eaten by a tiger.
Yes.
And you won't be doubt in your sanity.
Yes, I think so. We just don't know how earlier cultures that lived in much closer to nature and there was a genuine sense of maybe we're not all going to make it through today, you know. I think human beings still had room for this, even in such a world.
Well, they tried to, didn't they? I mean, you take North American. Native Americans.
Yes.
They had counsels of wisdom.
Yes.
But now we all come to mindfulness. It's a new thing now. So maybe we are at the beginning of it.
Yes. That leads us off into a reflection on the state of our civilization, and whether it's in a way reaching a kind of a place that's never been known before, or whether we're just getting back to something that was already there for people in the past. And there's a bit of both, I think. You know, we're getting back to something that was already known by former civilizations and former cultures, but we're getting back to it from a totally new place. You know, the totally new place is what our science and technology have revealed, that those earlier cultures never knew about, and they never knew about a brain either, and what the brain was doing. You know, we've got a whole other knowledge here that can inform us if we understand it rightly. If we understand it wrongly, then it leads us into the idea that it would be a good thing to build computers to take over the world. You know, that's a kind of a, it's all a matter of the context, the depth with which you understand it. Anyway, that it is the same thing. That was a long explanation of it is the same thing. It is only the manners of its sensible exhibition that are different. This word exhibition is a key word here. Because what the senses are doing is they're exhibiting the thing. If I remain within the realm of seeing, which we all tend to do, we all tend to favour seeing because it's the most detailed. I find new differences. Each phase of the process of seeing is itself a seeing. Like a frame, you know, as you move your eyes, and even if you swing your eyes across. I mean, people, again, in studying the brain, the eyes doing little saccades all the time. If you were to look at the back of the retina as a movie, you'd feel sick. Because things are just shifting. You know, and you just think that. All you're seeing really is the center of vision in this great detail and all this blurry stuff around the edge. If your sense of your, this is a very weird thing. If your sense of reality was, reality is what the retina's seeing, and you actually put your centre of gravity somehow on that, and that's what a video of what the retina would do, you'd have the thing that you were moving with the eye, and the eye's moving all over the place. But we don't have that. Our centre of gravity is centred in the body. And even then, if we start walking or moving or moving our head, you realise, no, actually, my sense when I'm moving is that I'm moving and it's the world that's still, and I'm moving across it as I move across the room. The sense of that is that I'm doing the moving and the room is staying still. Do you see that that's an extraordinary understanding? But it's an understanding that we literally feel. We feel these as our eyes move around, our sense of what remains the same is again something that is being projected. I don't think I've put that very well. I feel like I want to start moving across the room, you know. And here I am, I've got up and I'm moving around. And my sense of where I am in the space and of what's moving and what's not moving is a quite a deep understanding of the stationariness of the table, of the chair, of the floor, and that I do something. I move. Yes? and my whole sense of I move, why don't I experience the room shifting? That if I really had, if my sense of where the still point of the universe is actually in my body, then as I do that, I should experience, it's the room really that's shifting, because I'm the centre of the projection. But the projection is so organised that I don't experience it that way. I experience, I move, room stays still. The earth, for us, is the stable source of everything. It's what holds us up. And that's why it's so, for those of us who've lived in California, or somewhere like it, that's why it's so shocking when there's an earthquake. Because you just, the earth doesn't move. You know, and if there's an earthquake, it's very shocking. It's very shocking indeed.
I never thought of that.
Yes, it is.
I think about it when I'm in a train in the station, and both there is another train next to me, and then one of them starts to move.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's my train or the other.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great example.
Yeah.
You get it wrong. And suddenly you catch, I got it wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not moving. Yeah.
But you look for another sense.
Yeah.
You try to feel if your seat is moving.
I don't know what you do.
Backwards, and my train obviously was moving, and there was a train next to it moving as well. But I had a feeling that I'm moving forward because of the speed difference.
Yes.
Yes. In opposite directions, but just
and yet
backwards.
You don't feel movement.
Yes.
So that's kind of then confusing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, the whole thing about the moving in a train is very weird anyway, you know, because one sort of thinks, well, I'm going along at about, you know, 50 miles an hour here. When I let go of my phone, you know, why doesn't my phone fly down the corridor, you know?
Well, if you are in a plane and you wake up, are we in the air or we just...
Yes.
And you can't take it to ask somebody, but you get embarrassed.
Yes.
So I have to try to guess.
But I guess
what if it's dark?
I guess it's also a sense of it not being quite right for us. I mean, I don't know. I always experience that when I'm on the plane. It's like, this doesn't feel right. This is not what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not supposed to be up there. I'm supposed to be down here on the ground. And it's like almost as if, because it's a relatively new thing, is flying, isn't it? And so for us to be catapulting ourselves into something that's so not, like, goes almost against maybe our instincts, our instinct of fear, that, you know, when you're up high, then your body says, this is not a good idea. And you're fighting all of this natural sense making.
Yes, and yet we make it. We manage it. We make sense out of it, don't we?
But we don't always get it right. I was working for a lift a couple of days ago at the Turner exhibition. It was a big, spacious lift, two-thirds the size of this room, with somebody else. I pressed the closed doors button and then thought it would automatically move. And then we were standing there. Feeling that we were moving down.
And you weren't.
And then we realised, no, we're not. We actually have to separately.
Yeah, no. But that is an example of your experiencing your expectation.
But there was almost a physical.
Now, when you say almost a physical, the expectation is physical. It's not that you're imagining you're moving down. If the way that it works in the brain is if you're projecting that you're moving down, you're experiencing that.
Yes.
When you expect a phone call, you have the sometimes delusion.
Do you hear bells?
No, but they do experiments with white noise, you know, and they say, well, behind that white noise, you know, there's a candle in the wind, you know, there's the Elton John song, and you listen and you start to hear Candle in the Wind, but it's not there at all.
Oh.
You know, it's but that's the gain. It's the expectation that structures the experience.
I had this great experience. Not sure if anyone said before, but it was VR. But it was this program where you have to walk off the side of a building, and you fall down. And I found it really nerve wracking to do it. And so I was guided, and as I hit the ground, my legs give way, and basically they caught me. And apparently they have to do it to everyone. As soon as you hit the ground, your body just reacts, even though you know it's a virtual reality simulation. And it's obviously, you're in a room, you're in an office like this. As soon as you hit the ground, your legs just buckle.
That sounds horrendous.
It was.
Well, that reminds me of the rubber hand illusion. Do you know about the rubber hand illusion?
Yeah.
Where you've got your hands covered over here up to the elbow. So you can't see it, and there's another rubber arm down there, and somebody starts stroking the back of it, and at the same time behind you where you can't see, they're stroking exactly the same part of your hand. And I should actually do it, but it's well documented that after a while you it shifts and you start experiencing the sensation. The sensation in your hand is in the rubber hand, and what they love to do, and this is spoil it, and then somebody comes along with a fork and goes. You know, and of course nobody says, "Oh, it's a rubber hand." You know, you're utterly, it's completely, you see the projection of the body form. Is obviously, and that, I mean, they take it to an extreme where they in virtual reality they start to project. You're going to try and project. They achieve it where you project your whole sense of your body into another object. So we can be messed around with quite easily.
Dreams is so evident. Everything in dreams, like if you're swimming and you feel the water, eating something,
you taste
it.
So what is that then? Is that imagination or what is that?
Well, when we say it's imagination, it's the way that the senses work, according to the latest theory, is that we're continuously projecting, and you're looking in the brain, that means the brain itself is sending signals down in what we would call feedback down that hierarchy I'm talking about. And at the bottom of the hierarchy, if you like, are the sensory surfaces, the retina, the skin, the tympanic membrane. And the brain is sending signals down there saying, this is what I expect in the very next moment. Yes, and what occurs is just a comparison. Is what's coming on the retina, on tympanic membrane, on my skin, does it match what I expect? If it does, nothing happens. Yeah? And to that respect, you would say that what you're experiencing, if it's correctly predicting what's coming in through the senses, is literally what you're predicting. That's your experience is what you're predicting. Now, if something differs with the prediction, then it falls back up the hierarchy. That it's like at the next level up the hierarchy, it may just be a little thing, like you were predicting it would have a square edge and it has a round edge. And the next level of the hierarchy says, oh yeah, round edge. The hierarchy itself is engaged in what's considered to be probabilistic reasoning, and it's continuously predicting what it thinks is most probable. And if it falls back at the next level and it says there's a problem here, it'll take the new information and it'll process it and say, oh yeah, it's round, and it'll project roundness back down again, and the roundness will go, if you like, almost through the senses, right? It's almost like the projection is going, the senses are coming, which is the information coming from the world, and the projection, if it matches it, goes through it in a way, and you project what you're experiencing is literally what you're projecting.
But because the dreams are there. So if you dream that you're swimming, so there's no water inside, but you are swimming.
No,
the
dream is what occurs when the sensory surfaces aren't functioning at all. So you're purely experiencing the prediction. You're purely experiencing, and the prediction, then, the way it evolves is it evolves according to what's going on inside of you, and not according to what's happening in the world.
Where's it coming from? If you like Alex said, if you dream you're in water and you're swimming.
Why are you dreaming that you're in water?
Why? No, where's it coming from? I mean, why? Well, you could say why and where is it coming from? In your picture that we're talking about here with this perceiving thing.
So, I mean, where. At some level, and this is all hypothesis, yes? At some level, quite high up in the hierarchy, there's a certain kind of narrative forming, or a story, if you like, which would be an association of... we haven't spoken about this, but somewhere up here, there's going to be an area where we just have pure ideas of tables and chairs, and then individuated ideas of John, of Maria, and they can associate together, we don't just perceive things, we perceive events. In fact, it's almost like a thing, it really is an event as well. There's no such thing as a fixed thing. Everything that we see is always in this changing perspective mode. So at a certain level, a dream is a coming together of certain forms high up in the hierarchy that form a kind of a structure that's then projected down through the hierarchy as if you're predicting that that's going to happen in the world. But nothing's coming back from the senses. That's what it means to be asleep. So there's nothing to guide from the outside how that association that's going on in your brain is going to evolve. So it evolves according to its own logic. Now, what that logic is, we can only really discern by studying the dream. And I guess, you know, if we're Jungian, we would be suggesting that what's informing the dream is coming from something that's behind the brain. That there are two things behind the brain. There's the sensory source, which, although we can understand it, is itself mysterious. And then there's the psyche, there's also a kind of clearly a sense in which the psyche that's causing the dreams and the sensory world that's causing our experience are probably not. They're probably connected in some way.
Well, as you were talking, I was just seeing so clearly that in a dream we create this same three-dimensional world we actually created.
Yes.
And it has all of these a priori facets that we've been talking about.
Yes, yeah. The objects appear in the dream just like they appear here, right? When we see a book in a dream, we actually see a surface, and if we pick up the book, it moves like it moves here. We're using the apparatus that we've learned from the senses have taught us this, and then we're just replaying. We're replaying it without being connected to the senses.
But that's not always true. Like sometimes, for example, the continuity that Asra talks about does not always exist in the dream. You might change from one place to the other without when you wake up and realize I was seeing that in my dream and then it changed, but you don't really know how it changed.
Yes.
So
yes, it breaks down. The continuity breaks down, but that's a kind of an explanation of how our inner world works. it doesn't have the same continuity as the outer world.
The ideals break down as well, don't they? Like the book changes.
Yes.
Like you can have an object which you think this is a book, but it's not actually a book when you think, you know, in the waking world is not considered a book. So your idea of the book changes. It can do.
Yes.
Because they're not fixed.
Yeah, no, you can have the most weird confusions, can't you, where I have a dream and I think this is Nicolette. You know, when I wake up, well, it wasn't Nicolette at all.
Yeah, but you know.
You know, but in a dream it was Nicolette, you know, and I had no problem. You know, so all of the kind of checks and tests that go on, that the world, you know, well, I'm calling it the world. I don't know what the word is. It's the unthinkable source of experience, which we call the world. But it only becomes the world. That's our projected idea of it.
And the thing is that, well, at least in my experience, I never doubt myself in my dreams. I doubt myself from time to time in reality, especially when dealing with certain areas. But in my dreams, I never doubted myself.
Yes.
My flight, good, I'm fine.
Yes. 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 Yes, but you can lucid, you can have lucid dreams, can't you? I mean, it's like there are levels of consciousness in dreams too.
Absolutely. And then there is meaning, isn't there? So how we make maybe meaning of the pen over there in real life, that we use it to write something, the meaning in a dream becomes a different one. Potentially, so I mean, what do they say is the subconscious, and so it's like we have another. So we have the way to read meaning of something in real life, and then another area where we have a different meaning for these things.
I mean, you're reminding me. You see, what happens in ordinary experiences, we're continuously being held in check by the actual state of the world, or of this unthinkable source of experience. But in dreams, we're not. There's no such control going on. And
you
know, in ordinary life, you look at something and it reminds you of something else, or it you know, particularly reminds you of, say, something that happened in your past if it upsets you. You know, we're continuously trying to project stuff into our immediate experience. But generally, you know, the dear old things around here remain sort of resolutely obstinate that they're actually here. So that when that is, you know, because we're continuously projecting things into people, and if there was nothing coming back from the person, they would literally turn into that devil or that angel, do you know, that somehow is in the back of your mind. And the same thing with, I look at a car and it reminds me of my childhood. You know, there's a sort of level there where if it wasn't for the sensory world, I would probably go into something from my childhood, because in a dream, it's what's associated with what that seems to connect things. And not just that, it's very weird, isn't it, that there's something going on in you and the dream world seems to be able to translate that into something that on one level just looks like a thing in the world, but behind it meant something else. You know, it's a very puzzling world. And we have to, it's interesting that we're all very interested in dreams, because of course Husserl's, this would be for Husserl, something that we'll do later. We have to start with perception, because perception is, we have to bring our consciousness to bear on this, and we can't bring our consciousness to bear on dreaming unless we are lucid dreamers, and that's a kind of a very specialist kind of area. You know, first I think you can train yourself to sort of wake up in a dream and know you're dreaming. If you can wake up in a dream and know you're dreaming, then you could start possibly to do some kind of lucid phenomenology of the dream world. But in a way, you know, you have to start here, right? Where we all agree, more or less. I mean, if we get to the end of the lecture, we'll get into that question of agreement.
Yeah. have a question about the back to the hand illusion experiment. For how long can we trick the brain? Like, is the, because I think it would be with virtual reality, it could be used very nicely or very badly for like torture. Yes. So how when I put the fork, do I really feel the pain, or is it just the reaction?
Well, I think you'll be you will have to try it. I think the thing being that I my prediction is that you would start to feel the first jab of pain because you'd be predicting it, but then when you pull your hand out, you know you've pulled your hand out and the rubber hand didn't move,
but
so it's the illusion's shattered.
What if the hand is tight, so I cannot move it?
Well, no, not just that. Then, yes, we'd have to work on that. You'd have to actually have the rubber hand fixed. But you can break the illusion quite easily. You have to be in agreement with it in a way by just lifting your finger.
Yeah.
If you can.
Yeah. Now, yeah, if you can. And I mean, maybe if you get to a point where you've injected the hand in such a way that you can't move it, but you can still feel it, you might be able to...
Mindfulness and senses, touching, you know, realizing and acknowledging your fingers touching something, even if you can't move it, just gets in there. Pilates for you.
Yes.
Hands. I was at school, we were told, there was this experiment where someone was blindfolded, and like, you're going to be burned now, you're going to be burned now, you're going to be burned now. So they standard temperature object is held next to the skin, and there was burn there.
Is it actually physically visible?
Yes.
Like a red mark?
Yeah.
Probably the cells weren't damaged, but we have to look into that.
Yeah.
I don't think we could damage the cells, but we might be able to, because we're looking at there's feedback going down the nerves that could cause that.
Mm. But phantom limb, when you have a limb removed,
yes,
there's definitely recognised,
yes,
people with phantom limb pain. Most,
yeah,
definitely, you know, if you've lost your leg or your arm, or you know, you get. You know, there's many papers written on phantom limb pain where people get, you know, they're just literally, they do feel pain, you know, for some time. For, you know, I don't know, for, you know, kind of gone for a long time. So they haven't, their whole, you know, they just feel pain and have to be treated for pain.
Twins sometimes get it, you
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
It takes quite a while to get over.
It's like this American social experiment where the triplets were separated and placed into different families.
Yeah, there was a movie, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was a social experiment.
It's
yeah.
quite cruel. What's the film called?
It was a documentary,
yeah,
a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but there was a bit of fuss about it on Radio
yeah,
4,
yeah.
you know, about how wrong it was. And, but let's come back. We're coming back
yes.
to this. You know, because Husserl, in a way, he's talking about. He doesn't use the word projection. He's saying that our experience is constituted by transcendental subjectivity, and I guess I'm continually pointing on this side, and I'm saying, and if you look into the brain, you see that the brain is a kind of a representation of that. This is one of the ways I think about this, how the material world is, what it shows us, what it has to show us, is a kind of a reflection of what transcendental subjectivity is doing. Because that's what transcendental subjectivity is trying to do. It's trying to give us a reflection of what is. That's its task, in a way.
Using us as a source. or?
Well, then as you go back into transcendental subjectivity, the recognition is that I'm not separate from it. There's no what's separate? It's like there are two kinds of intentionality operating. The intentionality that shifts from your hand to the rubber hand is not something that you say, "Oh, I'll do that now." It just occurs, right? So the all of this constitution of the world just occurs, and even though your brain knows that it's an illusion, your egoic will cannot override it. Yes, so there are two intentionalities at work. Purcell called the one anonymous or passive, and the other is something that we would call we have a certain conscious will that can affect things here. And so transcendental subjectivity, it's an interesting thing, because you would say, well, it's not the me, the willing me. It's not the conscious egoic me. But at the same time, if you go back into a pure state of being conscious, then the intentionality that's anonymous is coming out of that, isn't it? Where else is it coming from? Maria, because it's not as if we're looking at some amazing realization. It's just as you fall back, essentially you don't think about it, because what thinks is not the transcendental subjectivity doesn't think. It projects thought like it projects computers. Do you see the I don't know how to put it, but it's just a sense of the presence of it. If I'm not identified with the person that's being projected out of it, then what am I? Well, maybe it's a wrong thing to say I am transcendental subjectivity, but it would be a wrong thing to say I'm not. There's no I really in it. That would be another way of putting it. There's just the field itself doing what it does. Like now.
The conscious will is born out of that, what has been the occurrences.
I mean, because I feel Maria's skepticism is driving at something, because even to say transcendental subjectivity is to imply that there's a thing. And there's no thing doing it. It's just happening, isn't it? Or if there is a thing doing it, we don't get to meet it. You know, it's not as if transcendental is going, "Oh, it's great you've been talking about me. You know, I thought I'd better introduce myself."
I guess I'm taking the easy way to it, just pointing someone responsible for all this.
Yes.
No, it's not that easy.
Yes. Yes. It's in so far as we reflect and think, we objectify what can't be objectified. So we have to sort of walk around it and be very careful about the language we use.
And there's also this whole thing of the speed of perception. Like when we watch a film, of course we're not conscious of all those frames going through the projector, we're just seeing in one smooth film.
Yes.
And it's the same in our brains. There are all these gaps that we're not aware of, because we're we're getting this feedback from our senses, which are operating at different speeds and corresponding to different levels of outer reality.
Yes.
You know, when I touch the table, it's a particular thing that I'm, as we were saying earlier, we're connecting it all together. But there's a lot of things that we accept that we don't perceive at all, say simple radio waves.
So we're in an area that's going to make it hard to get out of this slide.
Well, I think
which
it's very
is
interesting though. We want to know though. I mean, we could just sort of gloss over it and say, let's do all the slides and hurry
and
on.
Bear in mind,
and then go home and have a cup of tea. But it's very actually very good that we don't want to just let you gloss over things, and we don't want to gloss over things that are interesting.
Well, I hope there's no gloss here.
Well,
I hope there's no gloss here.
Because we've only got 4 hours.
Yes, but I was only. We don't have 4 hours now, John. But what I was going to say, because I've looked into this as well, because there are people looking into the nervous system and saying, oh yeah, actually, it clearly is the case that if you're looking at this synchrony of firing, that. In effect, there's something like a movie going on in the brain, that we are aware of this configuration, and now we're aware of that configuration, and there's a gap where things change, where we're not aware, yes? But there's a confusion here of time, where if we in consciousness have no experience of the gap, then there isn't a gap. The gaps in the objective time.
Yeah.
We create the idea of a gap.
The idea being then is, oh, there's a period there where I was just not conscious. But that, you see, places the reality into the objective. Whereas, again, if you're in this experience of being conscious, there's no gap. Because one of the fundamental aspects of being conscious, I put it to you, as you fall back into this, and you don't think about it, is you literally experience your own continuity. The continuity of being conscious, I mean. Not the continuity of a thought. In a way that you... I mean, I can't put it into words for you. It's actually at the very heart of the structure of time. There's this moment now. Are you on it? It's absolutely still. It's the sheer endurance. By enduring, I mean unchangingness. Within which everything that changes is appearing. And the epoche, although Husserl doesn't describe it this way, for me is a recognition of what consciousness is, and that consciousness in some sense is indistinguishable from now. And that's where language starts to fail. There's something here that is utterly still and utterly receptive, that doesn't move, that just presents what is. And it's always now. Even though, you know, when I'm talking about sound, you can hear the immediate past of what I'm saying. But the immediate past of what I'm saying is now. It's always now. Whatever you do, whatever you think about, if you go back and you remember what happened yesterday, you haven't gone back and remembered what happened yesterday. You're experiencing something now. Do you see? You just can't leave it, and you can't experience there being a gap or a discontinuity in it. And as phenomenologists, the fact that you can't experience such a gap means there isn't such a gap. Even though objectively you'd say, oh yeah, what's going on in the brain is like frames in a movie. But what's going on in the brain is not what you're experiencing.
But if our senses are artificially made better, and we suddenly experience the gap, what then?
But what would it be to experience the gap? It would
acknowledge it.
It would. What you would say? But if you experience the gap, it wouldn't be. It would be an experience. Experience of blackness.
God, you got me. Yeah.
Yeah. What were you, do you see what I mean? If there's a gap, then there's that means absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Yes. That means that you experience this. And then there's a gap, but where's the gap? It's not in consciousness.
Because it's in the experience.
The gap's in the world. And then if you were to experience the gap, then you'd just be... Then your consciousness would include what was happening between those two points. But as it is, your consciousness is only cares about the peaks. You know, if the brain's going like that, consciousness is just taking the peaks and making it into this... continuity of now. All right, John?
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. See, we got some. Yeah.
I like it.
This is a good slide. This slide.
Yeah.
I'm going to.
No,
I'm going
to explore the whole reading. I do like to explore the whole reading.
Yes.
It's not like
right. I find new differences. This is in the process of seeing, which is almost like the slides, you know, the frames. Each phase of the process of seeing is itself a seeing, but what is seen in each one is something different. What is visible of the thing is first of all a surface, and in the changing course of seeing, I see it now from this side, now from that, continuously perceiving it from ever different differing sides. But in them, the surface exhibits itself to me in a continuous synthesis. Each side is for consciousness a matter of exhibition of it. You're making me want to think about time again, John. Well, you see, this continuity of consciousness we project into the thing. You don't say, oh, look, there's another thing. Oh, and there's another thing. And there's another thing. And there's another thing. The continuity of now, the enduring of now, which is the enduring of our being, we grant the same being to this stream of all of these aspects of these surfaces. That, and I mean, the fascinating thing is we do see surfaces and yet we see the book. I was just writing about this.
This book?
It was another book, but it was a book. If you look at the book, I was playing around with a photograph. We took a photograph of this book, but what I mean to say is it helps with the photograph, and you were to, the way that you're seeing it now, you were to look at a photograph of it and you were to measure the sides of the book on the photograph, and you were to measure the angles on the photograph, which is how it appears in two dimensions, you'd find that there was no 90 degree angle in that image, and all the sides are of different lengths. That side is not the same as that side. This side here is longer than that side there, from where I'm looking. It's the other way around for you.
Yeah.
Yes? Now, I see all of that, all of those differences, and yet I see a rectangular book at the same time. I see it's rectangular. Do you know? I really do see the rectangularity of the book. And you actually have to pause and say, but what I actually see is the surface of the book. And yet I see the rectangularity at the same time. You can almost feel the idea of the rectangularity. You almost feel it coming down. You see, you understand its rectangularity so immediately, you think you see it, but you don't see it. I mean, it emerges as I turn it, as I turn the book around like that. The rectangularity emerges because of the relationship between the way that the sides are moving. That relationship, as it works like that, defines it as rectangular. But do you see, you're utterly unaware. Something in the brain has done that, but you're utterly unaware of it. You just experience the obvious rectangularity of the book. And if it broke down in some way, you'd be shocked. And the same goes for the colour. It's quite a dead colour, that one. Maybe I should be looking at the... from where I'm looking, it's all lovely and bright there, and then it sort of fades off and gets darker. And where my hand is, there's... Oh, as I move my finger over there, see the colour of the surface? Oh, changing. Changing, 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 changing. But there's another little bright bit there. Of course, I can make it go dark. Everything is in total movement. Do you see? Nothing. And it starts getting brighter. It's brighter and brighter and brighter. It's totally changed.
Does he do that a lot, sir? Yeah. Do you find him looking at objects?
There was a period of time actually in my early phenomenological career where I would be found sitting at the table going, my God. I it soon dawned on me, right, that artists are doing this all the time.
Yeah.
You know, this is the world of the artist. If you want to paint something, you have to start seeing how colour works. But like the angles and the lengths of the sides, you see all of the variation of the colour of the surface, and yet you see that it's a uniform colour. You see the uniform colour, but you don't see the uniform colour, right? It's obviously nothing here has a uniform colour. And yet, it's brown. I see it's brown. It's not brown. You know, look at this, the crease in it. It's gone grey in the crease. But I know it hasn't gone grey in the crease. I know that it's brown, because it's gone grey in exactly the way it has to go grey if the light's shining on it that way. There's something extraordinary going on with colour. I mean, colour is another language. The way that the colour changes expresses the form.
Absolutely.
Like the words that I use express ideas. Do you see, the colours are pointing towards the form. They express the form.
And sometimes even temperature, I guess.
Yeah.
So if you had fire.
Yes.
The red describes more than just its visual attributes.
Yes.
It also describes how it
gives you the sense
feel.
Warmth.
And temperature itself gives you a spatial sense of how far the fire is away from you.
Mm-hmm. And you can see, like, good painters, they tend to describe in details the forms, but like if someone hasn't got it or like never painted in their lives and ask them to paint something, they paint something completely.
No, can't do it. Can't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, the impressionists are the masters of this. I think it was with impressionism that somebody kind of go, bah, colour. A colour is doesn't exist. Do you see? It's, you know, like a word points to something. It doesn't really exist in itself. But you think the word... I say pen, and you think, well, yeah, here it is. But, the, you know, the word pen isn't anything, right?
Yeah.
And the same with colour. Colour isn't anything. It comes from transcendental subjectivity, for want of a better word, and it's the means by which the form of the world is expressed in consciousness. And we think that the colours are in the world, but no, the colours are telling us about the form of the world. If you were God, you would be going, now how am I going to make this idea I have into something that could be experienced? I've got this idea of form, but of course at the moment, because I'm God, the idea of form is something that we couldn't possibly understand. How am I going to make form explicit? I need something to show form. We go. And then, you know, colour, that's it.
Eureka.
That's it. And I often, again, you're thinking, does he, I get a lot from looking at the sea, you know, with the sunlight on the sea. You can, and this is why I think Monet was so obsessed with the water lilies. Do you know that this transcendental, and sunsets are the same, this transcendental aspect of colour, we don't see it because we just see the objects all the time, but there are liminal places, and the light on the sea is one of those liminal places where if you just look for long enough it starts to dissolve and you just see that, oh, it's just the colour. And the sunset's the same, you know, it suddenly the whole earth is bathed in another colour, and you suddenly think, oh gosh, there's the colour. Do you know that it's not all as it seems? We live in this dimensionality where there's something, the transcendental is in front of us every moment in the form of the colours. And I mean, it's the same for all the other senses, but colour seems to be the strongest one for us. And how we just see the objects that the colours present, but we don't see the colour.
There's the famous picture at Semipalp. This is not a pipe. It's like a painting. And it refers to this idea that because it's a painting of a pipe, it's not a pipe. So it's a painting of a pipe, and underneath you see, there's a caption that says, this is not a pipe.
Yes.
It's reminding you, like, you're not looking at a pipe. This is...
And but
it doesn't say it's a picture of a pipe, it just says this is not a pipe.
But that's what because it's a picture of a pipe rather than a pipe.
Yeah. But when you look at it, oh, what's this? It's a pipe.
But my sort of first, you know, proper experience of art was in front of an impressionist painting, and just seeing that it's right on the edge of just being a pure field of colour, and then there's the thing that it depicts, and it's pure colour. And then there's the, you know, the bridge in Monet's garden. Oh, there's the bridge. Now the colour, the bridge, the colour. And then there's something else in the genius of the artist about the form of the way the colours are put together. There's something in it that you can't express. There's a perfection in it. It's like you couldn't change anything of it. You sort of get the idea in a masterpiece that if you'd have just moved that dab of colour somewhere else, ruined. Do you know, it's there's something about everything everywhere is connected to everything else, and then just this all these marvellous colours are just daubed on this, bing, there's the form, and then form's gone, and it's just an amazing impressionist painting is just, it's in that liminal place where it almost, to me, I don't know if Monet knew this, but it almost says, transcendental subjectivity, it says. Here it is. Do you know? And it's saying, and it's there all the time, but there's something about art that can highlight something. You know, can make you notice something. Because it's got the almost the intelligence of the artist is there communicating to you.
And you can see them exactly the two ways, like a few dots of different colours, but they are people.
Yeah.
And you look at them, oh, they look like people, but hang on, they're just a few dots of different colours. And you can see it as a few dots of different colours, if you want, and you can see it as people.
Yes.
In a painting.
Yes. And you're reminding me of Cézanne. Well, Cézanne started to mess... Cézanne was the master of the surface. Do you see? We started to bring out what a surface is and started to see that the surfaces in Cézanne's paintings. There's something going on with an understanding of what a surface is in Cézanne, where the three-dimensionality of something is starting to be unravelled. I mean, these are... Do you know, because what Husserl's talking about, I think the artists are seeing too. Yeah, I'm afraid art started to die away after that. Once we got to Cézanne, and then something happened with Picasso. I was a few Picassos I can enjoy, but I started going, oh dear. Yeah. You see, for me, something happened around before the Second World War, which seemed to be the end of culture for me in Europe. I don't seem to be able to follow anything after that. Maybe it's some kind of reincarnation thing. I don't know.
So, well, I quite like Banksy. I think it's art.
Yes, I mean, if I was to bother, I mean, this isn't true. You know, I still think that there's sometimes I'm really. Quite struck by, you know, music. I think there was some life in music, even popular music. Still some living genius in it, and some of the movies still, even though there's all this money and compromise in them, sometimes the drama has something of art in it. But I feel we're sort of slowly starving for it.
Yeah, there's like a noise music.
Oh no,
like,
it's just a bit
old.
Yeah.
Also,
I'm sure in Berlin they're all like, I listen to noise.
Love a bit of industrial noise, yeah.
Noise, yeah. Do you know what
I'm saying? So we're going to finish this slide. We've only been you know, an hour and a half on it.
Oh,
yes.
Wonderful.
So And I don't like to go on job. I trust there hasn't been too much gloss on this slide.
Well, I think we could stay on it a whole.
Yes. But so the ever differing signs. But in them, the surface exhibits itself to me in a continuous synthesis. Each side, yes, I said that. While the surface is immediately given, I mean more than it offers. I mean, I've been looking at this again too. Again, I've been looking at the book, so I'm looking at the book again. The projection includes the volume that the book or whatever you look at, there's a volume that you can't see, it's not there, right? Again, you see, maybe this box is a good one because it's got a nice big volume. All I see is the three of the surfaces. For all I know, it could absolutely stop there, and yet I feel the volume of it. In a sense that you can't express it better than to say you feel it, you intuit it, but it's like a sense of what it would be like if I were to. It's got a if I were to pick it up, if I were to turn it over, it's got that. You know, that's the when we're saying it's the idea that the senses in a way contain a prediction. They're predicting what is immediately there, but they go beyond that. They're predicting what is not immediately visible, but doing it in a non-sensuous way. Do you see there's the sensuous prediction of the actual surfaces that are present, and then there's a non-sensuous prediction of the surfaces that are not present, which the best word that I have for it is that we have an intuition of the shape of it, and we have an intuitive sense of the hidden sides, and we have the a complete understanding of the unity of the thing, and I mean we've got to get to the later slides, because he expresses it in a way that I don't want to say now. I want to get to what Husserl has to say. So I mean more than it offers. Agreed? I mean, even with the surface that I do see, I mean more than it offers. I mean it's rectangular. It's not offering me obviously rectangular shape. It's a uniform colour. It's not offering me a uniform colour. There's an entire understanding that is almost futural, and yet it's still present to me now. When I say the understanding is futural, it's composed of what I expect, but I don't experience it as, oh, I know what that will look like if I did that. It's all wrapped up into an intuition of, this is the object in front of me and all of it's there, but at the moment it is exhibiting one side of itself. And I don't experience it, oh, I'm seeing a surface. I experience it, I'm seeing the thing that just happens to be showing or exhibiting this surface at the moment. I mean, all right, and that's a good long time on. We'll have a break at 12. I'm going to read this slide and see if I can stop myself from digressing. What I attribute to the thing itself, its seen, coloured shape in the alteration of near and far orientation. I mean, that's just the other thing, you know. Don't start. I had, because you were talking about trains, I feel I've got to say this. I was in Australia at Narang Station, and Nicolette got on the train. And, you know how you do, oh, bye, you know. And she got on the train, and then off the train went, and it just got smaller and smaller and smaller until it was that long. And it suddenly dawned on me, this can't be real. Do you know, Nicolette can't be in there. She'd be about that big. What could I do? You know, I can't live with someone who's that big. It can't be. Do you see? If we literally said that's the train, it's like I mentioned Picasso when you said when someone showed a photograph and he said, well, but she's so small. Do you know this? It's not real. Do you know it's that? What I see is a projected image of the train as it should look if it were that far away from me. You know, and it's all like the houses over there. You know, I'm looking over there, and I think I'm actually seeing the houses over there. Well, in a way, I am, but they can't be that. They're not that small, are they? Look, do you see the flat on the? It's that big. How can you fit people into something that big?
But it couldn't be the other way around, because you can't have, you couldn't have things the same size.
Exactly. It couldn't be.
Yeah.
But you see, in a way, we feel that we're experiencing things exactly as they are. But if we were to experience things exactly as they are, then we would be experiencing them the size that they are.
That would be impossible.
Which would be impossible.
Because you'd have to be it.
You'd have to.
Yeah. Absorb some distance.
That's exactly it. You'd have to be everything at once. I mean, the philosophers who, you know, still in the Christian era,
right,
used to think this way. They'd say, well, that's how God really knows things as they are. God knows the flats, because God is the flats. You know, this was, what's his name, who wrote The Ethics? Spinoza. Yes.
Sorry.
God has it all right. God doesn't see it from perspectives, but we're forced into perspectives that inform us. Again, the things get smaller in order to tell us how far away they are. The size of something is an expression of I mean, it's an expression of time almost. I start to think of it as time. Heidegger had a great, he called it deseverance. I'm severed from that. Yes? And the expression of the deseverance of that is that it's got tiny. And how tiny it's got is an expression of the time it would take me to get to it. You know, it's like the space that I'm projecting the space, which is expressed by the size, which in a way is it kind of encodes all the steps that I would have to take to make that thing the size it is again. Do you know, I actually have to pull it towards me, and as I pull it towards me, it becomes, and at last now it's the right size so I can get in it. Do you see it? What an extraordinary...
Well, you can go beyond that too, where it's too big. It's too
far. Yeah, that's right.
Going back
yes.
to the fellows that didn't make it through evolution, who were seeing this whole thing, but they couldn't cope with it.
Yes.
We have to help an animal to have lunch. So it has to become the right size, has to become that close to me so I can...
Of course. I mean, and then we start diving into it, you know, especially if we start eating it. And then we have all these devices now where with the microscope we keep going. Do you know? And the telescope we head out.
Severance, like it's necessary. It's necessary that we're always severed from everything. Because you can't have any other way, can you?
Well, I'm not severed from my body.
That's the
body. I mean, if we get to it, we may even get to talk about the body, but the body has the body's an intriguing in between. I mean, in a way, you know, my hand gets smaller, so it's like the block of flats, you know, and it's huge now, but my internal feeling of the sensation in the hand, I'm unified with it. It doesn't have a perspectual thing, the inner experience of the body. And not only that, it's a very strange place, isn't it? Because I'm lord of this body, you see. I think I'll just turn my hand over. Shall I? I mean, I didn't issue a little notice and somebody ran down and the hand says, oh, I don't think so. Right? I just think it and it's so. Think it, it's so. I want to say something, I say it. I mean, I've got some control over the book, but I actually have to... You know, it takes time. I don't just think book rise. And the thought it rises. I have to go over and it takes time, right? Everything's severed from me in time, but my body isn't severed from me in time. It's, you know, the physiologist will say, well, actually it is. You know, if you look at the neural signal, it takes time for the neural signal to indicate something to your arm, which gets to your finger, and there, you know, there's several hundredths of a second delay in you thinking that you're going to move and you're actually moving. But again, that's like the gaps in the objective time. For you know, I scratch my head. I am unified with it. That's the body is an amazing, an absolutely different entity for us phenomenologically. This is another way where objective science, if you flip into objective science, your body is just the thing. Yes, it's just the thing like any other thing. But if you come back into the actual field of experience, it's this utterly unique for each one of us. It's a field of potentiality, isn't it?
Mm.
It's a vessel.
A what?
A vessel.
A vessel with a V. Yes. Well, I mean, I'm not sure that I know how to describe it. You know, because we were talking about projection of form with the rubber hand experiment. So there's a certain projection of form with the body, but this can disintegrate too. You know, if you shut your eyes and you go really still, have you had it where you the sense of the being fingers can start to go wrong. You know, your differentiation of your sensory experience can just start to form just a much more amorphous just sense of tingling potentiality. I mean, I'm sorry about this, but John's been encouraging me. The bodies, and the sensory fields are all like this. If you there's a tingling in the hands that's quite easy to pick up on. And we've looked at this before. Utterly different. As soon as I touch something, it's not tingly anymore. My sense when I touch something is it's the tingling is not distinct. Do you know, it's moving, sensating. There aren't any hard edges. As soon as I touch something, there's a hard edge. You know, touch is a very good one to get how the senses work. There's a sort of a sensating in the senses, but when you perceive something, it doesn't sensate. The table's not sensating. My perception of the table is of something quite fixed. The edge is a sharp edge. There's no tingliness to the table. And yet my touching the table is somehow connected to this tingling potentiality in my hands. But if you start to move out into the hearing, can you hear it hissing? I don't want to give you tinnitus. If you've got tinnitus, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. Do you hear the way that the hands tingle? There's a tingling in the background of hearing. Can you sense it? I mean, if you get in an absolutely silent room, then it's a bit easier. But even as soon as you tune into it, it's like touching the table. As soon as you tune into a sound, what you hear is the distinct clarity of the sound.
The clock. Sorry for that.
No, it's fine.
But in the background, all of these sounds, there's a sensating field. And if you shut your eyes and just look into the back of your eyes, there's the same sensating going on there. I mean, for me, I've done this over the years, so I just shut my eyes and see it. Ba-bing. I probably took me some time to do that. Once you recognize it, it's there wherever you look. And yet, it's like defocusing. You can look through and see the sharp objects around you. You don't see the sensating. But if you want to, you just need to stare a little bit at a wall or something, and you can start to see the sensating is going on.
So, I mean, I don't want to bring drugs into it too much, but I do believe that when you take mushrooms, for example, you experience the otherness or the other, what else an object has to offer that we don't see, or, you know, I mean, so say the hands, for example. So looking at the hands, all of a sudden you see the vibrating that goes on there. You might hear it. So it's as if your normal sense-making systems are down and you experience all the rest that everything has to offer.
that we don't need to read otherwise.
Well,
the cells of something.
I mean, I think everybody has different experiences on mushrooms. We do, don't we? But there's a. There's a. Certainly. Because psychedelic drugs can go into hallucination, but they don't have to. There's a level where there's a sense that you're seeing things more real. There's a greater reality in what you're seeing than there is in ordinary perception. Like certain, a bit like, I mean, this was Aldous Huxley's understanding of it, that this kind of honing down of these pathways from when you're a child, where they're all kind of knocked out, has narrowed us down so that we only see what we expect to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like we're predicting what we expect to see, and that means if something unexpected comes along, unless it's kind of dangerous in some way and we're attuned to it, we just don't see it. And I don't know if there's a famous movie of these people, could be us, sitting around, and they've been told to throw a basketball around to each other, and in the middle of it all, somebody in a gorilla costume walks right through the middle of them, and nobody sees it. Because they're all waiting for the ball, you know. For those who's not engaged in the game and not concentrating on the ball, it's like shh, shh, shh. And I think it's a bit like that. It's like there are lots of gorillas walking through the room in a way, you know, but we're just not attuned to it. And something about the psychedelic drug knocks us out of our obsessive attunement with what we're expecting all the time. But then so, in a way, just doing this, you know, what we're doing now, is a kind of a tuning out of the objectification of everything.
Essay called Doors of Perception.
Yeah. Yeah, now I look back on it, my English teacher gave me that book, said, John, read, and I was, 15 or something. And I'm thinking, at the time I thought, oh, all right, you know. And now I look back and I think, what was she thinking there? And why did she decide to give it to me? You know, I think she must have seen something in me, right? You know, but then nothing was ever said. She didn't come back and say, oh, you know, what did you think of that, John, or anything. It was one of those odd things from school that I reflect now and think, oh, if I was to meet her again, I'd say, do you remember? Now look, no, there's no lunch till we get through this, and it was my own fault as well, and Rekha even tried to stop me, so I acknowledge all of that, but let's get to the perspectives, that was all about, remember the train, that's what sent me off. The perspectives are different, but each is an exhibiting of this shape, of this colour. So do you see, however far away something goes, however small it gets, we still see the same thing. It's amazing, isn't it? And we don't even blink about this. We don't even pause. And this holds in every modality of sense perception, touching, hearing, of the same thing. As things get quieter, you know, our sense of smell, it gives us the sense of distance. In the course of alteration, they all play their role as exhibitings, now being interrupted, now beginning again. They offer many types of manifolds of exhibitings, each of which functions as an exhibiting of. Do you see, there's everything that shows itself in all of the senses is, I mean, he's going to use the word index. It refers back to this unity that we hold in mind all the time with everything that we see. Because we're still just talking about the perception of a thing. In running their course, they form a synthesis of identification or unification. Right? Everything we don't think, because we've done the unification, we don't see the unification. But everything is changing all the time as my eyes flick over it. And as all of the different surfaces of things show themselves to me, we don't notice that they're being unified. I mean, I feel a lovely digression going on about movement now. I mean, I find movement's another thing. If you pause and just, I'm watching that. I don't ever actually see it move. Do you? I don't see it move.
What do you mean?
Well, it's not moving. It's like, it's almost like John says. What's moving?
The background's
not moving. At any moment, right? I don't see anything moving.
Wait till you get the pain in your neck until you realise what was moving.
To see the finger move, in a certain sense, you'd have to see it go from one point to the next. Which means you'd have to hold the last point in view, but you don't ever see the last point it was at. You only ever see where the finger is now, don't you? I mean, if you listen to sound, sound is decaying, and you've got to sort of, you hold on to the past of where the sound has just happened, and it decays away. But my finger doesn't decay away like that. I don't have a vague sense of a finger in where it's just been kind of fading away. I just see the finger itself. Let me put it this way. Here I am moving it fast. Here I am moving it slowly. How do I know that it was moving fast? Do I see it moving fast? You think you see it moving fast.
Yeah, but
you don't see it moving fast, do you?
You have your sense of...
Your sense.
Yeah.
You just see it moving, right? But what do you, what do you see? Are you getting the distinction? You know it's moving, and you know how fast it's moving, but you don't actually see it. You feel it. You feel it like you feel the hidden side of the box. Our experience of vision is like the movie camera. Frame, 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 frame. And we add movement to it as a sheer intuition. And not just a sheer intuition, something's moving, but how fast it's moving. And we have a complete, as I turn my hand, a total anticipation. See, like with the sound, I have retained where the hand just was, and I am pretending, is Husserl's word, where it's going to be, but I don't see the retention and the pretension in vision. I simply perceive it. I perceive, I have this intuitive sense of the course that this movement's taking. So, you know, I perceive the whole movement, really, all at once, but I only actually see the present moment of it. Do you see? I perceive the movement, that this movement here, in its arc. I'll do it again. I mean, I perceive it differently too, because I've got a whole kind of motor command that I've used many times before.
Are we doing a similar thing to the argument of the neurons firing? That's not actually seeing anything. That's just neurons firing. Just because I can't actually see it doesn't mean that I'm not seeing it.
Well, what I want to get to is that in any particular moment, you're having an actual sensation, a sensory experience of what the colours are doing, if you like. I know the colours are really showing you something, but in any particular moment, they're showing you something. But your knowledge of movement is a knowledge of a form, of a certain kind of event, the event of me moving my arm, you have a knowledge of that event, but it's a pure intuition, like the intuition of the form of the... You have an intuition of the form of the shape of something, even though you see its surface. You have an intuition of the form of a movement, even though you only see the momentary aspect of the movement. You've got this other dimension that we never look, do we? We say, oh yeah, it's moving. The actual knowledge of movement is an extraordinary intuition in another dimension to your actual vision. It's a sheer knowing. It's a knowing where my hand's been, and it's a knowing where it's going.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about my hand, because I don't have to see my finger to know that it's moving because of the internal senses. But for example, I'm waiting for a train, and it has arrived, and then it left. So it did something. It didn't just disappear into the thin air.
Yes.
Or did it? It
so
moved
yes.
From this point to somewhere else.
Yes. But you didn't, all you saw, like a movie, was train here, train here, train here, train here, train here, train here, train here. You didn't experience any gaps either. But what I'm asking you, what held it together? This is the unification, right? What held it together? What stopped it falling apart into being just train moments? Well, the first thing is that there were no gaps. And we're back to what John was talking about. Consciousness has this continuity. But even so, at any time you care to look, you can only see what's here now. You can't directly see the movement in the form that the colours present. The movement is not exhibited in the visual field as colour.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah? It's in another dimension entirely.
That's really tough, though, isn't it? Because we only describe movement as a discrete thing, as well as discrete units.
Yeah.
Do we have a continuous definition of movement?
It's the relocation from one place to another.
No, but I mean, like, you can only describe that as discrete, as something smaller than itself.
Well, when you start going into what movement is, you get into that, you know, paradox. What was it? Zeno's paradox.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can never overtake the tortoise. Because whenever you get to the tortoise, it's moved ahead of you. A tiny bit, but still, it's still got ahead of you.
Yeah.
You know, if you can infinitely divide up distance, then you can't ever reach the tortoise. So and that's not so, right? So it doesn't matter. That's objectified what is being presented here. The amazing continuity of movement that we just we don't need to work it out. All I wish here before we have a break is to see, but that's amazing. How do I do that? How do I perceive movement? It's a sheer knowledge. I know where my hand's just been, even though do you see? In order for me to see where my hand's just been, it would be like there's an after image there. You know, one way that you could sort of work movement out would be to freeze it and say, there's a hand a couple of seconds ago, it's already faded, I can see through it. You know, there could be a blur, and sometimes you can even get almost a blur of an after image. That would be getting closer to seeing what movement is, but we don't see it that way. And there are people whose ability to do this apparently breaks down, and they really do see. They don't see movement. You can have actually, if with the right kind of brain damage, you can lose your ability to perceive movement.
Yeah.
even though you can still see. So that there is a, you know, there's an empirical place that I don't think anyone would want to be in, unless you could have it temporarily induced, where you would really say, oh gosh, so that's it. But it's the same as the intuition of depth. You know, you'd have to have the whole world flattened for you to see what difference it is. That depth is a kind of a pure knowledge as well.
What's mysterious to me, like how could the organism develop the chemical compound to make this brain chemistry to allow the organism navigating to reality?
Well, we are all made of star stuff. So we're all miracles.
Like how could the organism figure out the chemical concoction to allow the organism to capture what's going on around it?
So, lunch soon. The best, if we're being scientific or physically objective about the body, then the best way to understand the body is to be scientific about it. And the scientists say the body was not at all interested and didn't evolve. It wasn't in any way concerned with anybody having any kind of experience. The body is entirely a kind of a mechanism for survival. And the best way for a body to survive that doesn't have huge teeth and claws and armor, the absolute edge that you could give to a body is for it to have a better knowledge of the future. So we're just looked at physically, our bodies are devices that can see further into the most probable outcome of what's going to come next. So our that's all, and we don't see into the future. We basically, in a way, we're a little device that calculates the most probable train of events, and we've got a brain now that's got sufficient neocortex that it can imagine events that aren't happening. You know, a certain amount of neocortex is needed just to process the events as they are. But we now have neocortex that can switch off the senses and say, well, what if I took this little noose here that I've just tied up and I put it in front of the rabbit hole, and I got a cane and hung it over so that it will flick up when the rabbit sticks his head in it and will strangle it, you know. Although there are certain tool-making abilities in, you know, the higher apes, no animal has been capable of envisaging something that complex. Do you see? So we're evolution. It doesn't matter to evolution, to survival, whether we're having some kind of amazing experience of this or not. It was all needed. The mechanism was needed. What comes in the senses, the more that I can predict what's going to happen next, the better I'm going to survive. So the brain is entirely about generating surviving behaviour that's going to further my survival.
And yet retain that sensitivity that is so necessary for others. Areas too. We were talking about art, not part of survival, right? But we know in general terms.
So yes.
We've retained, we haven't got claws and thick skins and slow-witted things, but we can survive in snow. We've got a very, very sensitive organism.
Yes.
And yet, because we can predict the future more intelligent, more exactly, more
yes,
with accurate prediction.
Yes.
Then we can retain this sense, that we've retained this sensitivity to it.
Yes.
Which has put us at the top of the pile, even though we live as if we're at the bottom, actually.
Exactly.
The top, yeah.
And the whole understanding of the brain from this point of view of evolution has come under, is now kind of expressed as the free energy principle, which is saying that the entire, this is why, you know, the brain is this, the neocortex is the same everywhere, because it's doing, it's trying to do the same thing. It's trying to organize the life of the little body here in such a way that it's see, free energy is a kind of measure of disorder. And what the brain is trying to do is to minimize the disorder within itself. And the way it minimizes the disorder within itself is to be able to predict its incoming sensory information. But it doesn't just predict it. It can, this is the understanding now, it can change the sensory information by acting. And even acting, even our actions now, are predictions. There are certain predictions that we make about what's going to happen because something's coming towards us. But if we act, then that's another prediction. It's a prediction about how it, my picking up the book is a prediction of how the book is going to change when I move it. So the entire job of the brain is to minimize the disorder, which is to make the entire prediction of everything as perfect as possible. And all our actions, not just the brain's predicting what other things are going to do, all our actions of our bodies are intended to produce that minimizing of disorder. And the minimizing of disorder is having enough sleep, having enough food. You know, there are instinctual impulses that come into the brain that disorder it. And its job is to bring that back into order. So how do you get rid of the disorder of hunger? You eat. How do you get rid of the disorder of sexual desire? Well, we know. That's what the brain's for. It's to produce a state of equilibrium for us. That state of equilibrium is the state of survival, optimal survival. And the bigger the brain gets, the more it's able to control its environment. And do you see what civilization is? It's the externalization of this neurological tissue that's just attempting to control everything. I mean, it's gone mad. It can't do it, right? It's because it's only a little brain. But our civilization is that attempt to make everything predictable, sort of in, you know, cubed, or to exponential power. Because the more we try and control what we can't control, the more unpredictable it becomes, and the more we try and control it. And our technology is just an extension of that process of attempting to make everything predictable at a certain level. But
can I have a tea break?
You're right, yeah, yes, go ahead, tea break, yes.